This is an encore presentation of our Lake Effect Onsite show in Cedarburg.
From 89.7 WUWM Milwaukee's NPR, this is Lake Effect. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Tyke. Today on the show, we are in Cedarburg for our Lake Effect Onsite series ahead of the city's annual Strawberry Festival.
First, we're joined by the founder of the festival and the winery that made it all happen.
Then we'll meet people working to attract and help women get more comfortable with road cycling.
We'll learn about some of the work that's going on at the Mequon Nature Center.
And the band Chicken Wire Empire brings their heartfelt bluegrass harmonies as tonight's house band.
Lake Effect comes your way next. News is first.
This is an encore presentation of our Lake Effect Onsite show in Cedarburg.
This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. Thanks for tuning in today. I'm Mitch Tyke.
And I am Bonnie North. We are here in front of a live audience at the Cedarburg Cultural Center. This is a special edition of our Lake Effect On-Site series, and it's also a special edition of the show, as we say goodbye to our longtime executive producer and co-host, who's leaving for a new position in upstate New York.
It is a good time, yeah. It is a good time for us to be in Cedarburg, because it is Strawberry Festival Eve, the time each year when the city is overrun by fans of the delicious fruit and its many incarnations, pies, preserves, and wines. The festival, now into its 34th year, takes over the city's adorable downtown and bathes it in hues of pink and red.
And that is where we start this edition of Lake Effect Onsite. We're joined by Jim Pape, who's the founder of the Cedarburg Strawberry Festival and Cedar Creek Winery, as well as by Steve Danner on my right over there, who manages the winery, and BJ Homayouni, the executive director of Festivals of Cedarburg. Welcome to all of you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you.
So we can see what the festival is about to look like this year. I mean, I imagine we'll talk a little bit about what it's going to look like this year. But I want to flash back and ask what the festival was like 34 years ago.
In 1986, the fire department had a music festival, and they decided to drop the fourth weekend in June for that festival. And they had always, for 30 years, had good weather. We decided that would be a great opportunity to pick up that date for an event. And we were making sparkling strawberry wine at the time. And so we said, let's do a strawberry festival. So that was kind of the seeds of the whole idea, an open date and an opportunity to promote ourselves and the city with a new festival.
So how has it changed in the 3+ decades? Obviously, way more people come.
Well, yes. I mean, since then, we joined with the Chamber of Commerce to co-sponsor the event. And then it spread throughout the community. And so it became a community-wide event. And then when the street was closed, then it really opened up the festival to much more activities and much more people participating.
Let me throw this question to all three of you and maybe get each of your perspectives on it. How important to the strawberry industry at large is the festival, and how important to the festival is the strawberry business around the region?
Well, when we started, we had a grower, a Jerome Fechter, who had a strawberry farm. And he was our co-sponsor, you might say, of the event. And then since then, you know, he has converted his strawberry farm into a subdivision, so no longer
was
a resource.
Tasty, yeah.
But we now have other sources.
We have everything strawberry you can think of. So, of course, it's very important. Plus, it's one of the favorite fruits of everybody, and it really kind of signifies summer. Strawberry Festival is one of the first large events that Ozaukee County has that kicks off our summer. So it's definitely an important aspect.
Do we have any strawberry fans in the audience tonight?
Maybe ask them if they have any strawberry wine fans.
Yes.
They're the ones that are having a harder time sitting up.
Yes.
At the winery, the strawberry blush wine is seasonal. We've always released it mid-May, but the last, 10 years, we started releasing it a little bit early. Now we release it mid-April. we had gotten to a point where we had run out on a Sunday afternoon of Strawberry Festival. And it's problematic, but it wasn't the end of the world. Hey, it's 3:30, you showed up. Shoot, we should have came earlier. and that was okay. So we made a little bit more, and then we started running out like the first week in July. 10 years before that, it might last until September. You don't know. But then all of a sudden, first week in July, it's gone. First week in July, it's gone. The next year, all of a sudden, we're starting to limit it in May. And unless you're buying a whole lot, a truckload, you can't buy any in June because we needed to get to Strawberry Festival. We sold out Saturday afternoon at Strawberry Festival. There wasn't a riot, okay?
It is Cedarburg. It is Cedarburg. There wouldn't be a riot.
No, but but let's just say displeasures were expressed.
Yep.
Notes were taken, and so we just very much agree. We're not running out during Strawberry Fest anymore.
When do you start producing the wine? How long does it take to get it ready for market?
We bottled it a couple months ago, but really it started last season's grapes. It's a grape wine. We use Sauval Blanc grapes that our grower grows for us in New York. Grapes are brought in. We do those next in the fall, make a base, and then we add a strawberry syrup. And we do use a grape wine because it's a little bit more stable. We kind of, consistency of normal working with, rather than trying to use fresh strawberries, it might be a little bit different.
Why are strawberries kind of synonymous with this part of Wisconsin? What makes strawberries in Cedarburg a good fit?
They're available this time of the year, not any other time of the year, so it seems logical to pick that fruit that goes when you want to do that festival, right?
It's a timing thing.
Which is why this is not a peach festival.
Right.
But, fair point.
Yeah, they're the first fruit, too, though. I mean, what can you have before this?
Right.
That's a good point.
Fruit, I think broccoli's out, but that just didn't seem like the right choice.
Pea pods. Yeah,
right.
Somehow it just doesn't have the same.
Right. The pea pod festival.
The pea pod festival. So
We are talking on Strawberry Festival Eve, but I'm curious because BJ, you are the director of festivals of Cedarburg. How does the Strawberry Festival fit in the context of the other things that go on here over the course of the year?
This is the biggest event for us, so it's really kind of our jumping off for the season kind of festival. We just have so much to do with it. It's so big and it's so amazing, and we just have a lot of partners involved in it, so it's a really good catalyst to start the whole festival season.
Well, and I would imagine that one of the things that Strawberry Festival would do is introduce a lot of people to Cedarburg who might not otherwise have found their way up here.
Yeah, you know, Strawberry Festival, a number of years ago we did we got the Guinness Book of World Records in our partnership with Kemp's, and we have
What was the record for?
For the largest scoop of ice cream, which was 1,310 pounds, I believe, if I remember correctly. We've had a couple of records.
I want to see the cone that held that.
Well, yeah, it was actually, they had to create a bowl to do it, and it had to look like an ice cream cone, and we had to serve every inch of it to all the people.
So there is none left.
Yeah,
none.
So that actually put us on the map, and we were heard about all the way in India and other places. So yeah, this is the one that really gives us the publicity.
So we just have a few seconds left, but briefly for each of you, what are you looking forward to most about this year's festival?
Well, really, we hope that it's going to be good weather this weekend because it's weather dependent. So that's my focus.
Good hope. Good
yeah,
weather.
For us, we have the new, we're building the park is a bigger area, so it's Party in the Park. And so we're going to have the blues. We're partnering with another nonprofit to do a new blues thing in the park, and we're hoping that that's going to be a big success for us.
I like seeing some of the customers that come once or twice a year. They always come at Strawberry Fest, or they come Strawberry Fest at another festival, and just have them stop and say hello. I like to hear how they've been doing, what they've been doing.
Great.
Very cool.
That was Steve Danner, General Manager of Cedar Creek Winery. Jim Pape is the founder of Cedar Creek Winery and the Cedarburg Strawberry Festival. And BJ Humayuni is the Executive Director for Festivals of Cedarburg. Thanks to all three
Thank
of you.
Thank you very
Thank
much.
You.
Thank you.
We'll take a short break, and then we're going to talk with two of the people who help make women more confident and comfortable on their bikes. We'll join the Peloton before it gets too far down the road when Lake Effect continues from the Cedarburg Cultural Center on Milwaukee's NPR.
This is an encore presentation of our Lake Effect Onsite show in Cedarburg.
Lake Effect continues now on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Tyke. In case you had not noticed it, we are in the middle of a bicycling renaissance in southeastern Wisconsin. The Tour of America's Dairyland is running its 11th annual series of races this summer. Bike share stands have proliferated around the city and even into the suburbs, and dedicated bike lanes are more and more common on roads from the inner city to the exurbs.
The place where we're recording today's show is something of a mecca for road cyclists. Ozaukee County is crisscrossed by the interurban trail and scores of quiet, hilly country roads. But the sport is still often dominated by men, and our next guests are working to change that. Cindy Pettit is the founder of Wisconsin Women's Cycling, which leads rides and runs events and training programs from their base here in Cedarburg, and her husband Brian leads many of those training programs. Welcome to both of you.
Well, thank you.
Thank you, Bonnie and Mitch.
Why did you think an organization especially geared towards women, and we did appreciate the pun there, geared towards women, thank you. We'll just repeat it until you groan.
Yes.
Why did you think an organization especially dedicated to women and bikes was needed?
Well, I've been riding my bike for a long time, mostly with groups of men, and over they would say, oh yeah, it's a no-drop ride, so come on out, give it a try, and I would get dropped about maybe 3 miles or 5 miles into the ride. And they would say, see you next week. And I would show up, and it was like totally crazy. But as I was out riding on my own, I would come across a lot of women who were looking for somebody to ride with. So we would start connecting, or I would connect them with other people. And when I moved to Cedarburg, I found that to be the same. Even though there's a lot more opportunity to ride down here and a lot more clubs, but there were a lot of women that were still riding alone. So I had an idea, and I put it across to my friend Chris Cagle and said, what do you think? And he said, that's a great idea. Nobody else is doing it. So I got an advisory board, and we started Wisconsin Women's Cycling with the first women's century ride back in 2015.
And I think that was the first time we talked to you. I think it was the first time you were on the show.
It is, right. Thank you.
So 4 years into it, Brian, did you ever think about your own experience getting into the sport and how it might differ for women who wanted to take it up?
Yes, my background had been mainly up to this point bicycle racing. So again, male-dominated sports, but a lot of females as well, and a lot of bonding in the racing community. And I wanted to help Cindy get more women involved too, because I've seen that experience with what women had, at least in the race area, as well as just normal riding.
I think a lot of people think of professional cycling, certainly, as very gear heavy. Mm-hmm. You know, that you need to know about this, you need to be able to fix your bike, you need to have this, you got to have the right equipment to ride in. Are those some of the things that myths that you dispel for women who are riding with you?
Well, it's really funny. My title is a chief soigneur, and that means I pretty much handle everything so the rider can concentrate on riding their bike. They don't know anything about gears or equipment. A lot of it is donated through sponsorships. And very nice bikes and gear, by the way. So the racing group of people is like less than 1% of the people that ride bicycles. But that's what we're all kind of pressured to want to be, and you don't need to be. So we want to take away that myth, and we want you to be comfortable on your bike. We want you to understand road safety, some tips on how to enjoy a hill if you're going up or down.
I think I'm more scared going down most of the time, actually.
And yeah. A lot of people are. In fact, I teach people how to descent on road bikes, and we also have a mountain bike clinic and cyclocross, so you can learn off-road as well.
Do you think the dynamic has changed? I mean, not necessarily just in the 4 years that you've been doing this, but when you think about where cycling was for women when you started to pursue it as a love and where it is today, do you think it's changed, or are you still seeing, you know, a lot of people falling into the same traps that did, you know, 5, 10, 15 years ago?
Well, I think a lot of people are still falling into the same traps, but I think the industry itself has started from the top. The manufacturers of the bicycle
are pushing it down onto their dealers to be more friendly to the women. There's a lot of men that go into bike shops also, and they're really not sure what they're asking for. And Brian, do you want to add to that?
Well, that's true. The industry has been doing a lot of, again, catering to women, treating them as a separate market, treating them as, you know, a different sets of requirements for women riders. And again, the whole idea is to make them comfortable, make them have fun. The other things that are happening in women's cycling as well is that in, and again, not to get into racing, but in the racing area, they've been suggesting equal prize money for men and women. In fact, it's happening in the sport of cyclocross.
Yeah. And it's happening this weekend. We have Tour of America's Dairyland going to be at Grafton, and the prize money there throughout the Tour of America's Dairyland is also equal amongst the pros and some of the other prize money. So we're very happy about that.
So Brian, going back to what you're saying about, you know, getting things to fit, is that one of the problems for that has been a historical problem, that women couldn't find bikes that actually fit them?
Yeah, there was, again, being a male-dominated sport, again, sporting equipment was kind of set for that population of males. And again, not so much the frame sizes, but maybe seating, the reach, how long your arms are, the brake levers, that type of thing. Every aspect has now been re-examined and almost re-engineered, thanks to people like Trek Bicycles, for instance, in Wisconsin, and other manufacturers. And again, it's an opportunity for them to exploit or take in a market segment that they really didn't have before, that was incidental rather than being fully engaged.
We're up here in Cedarburg, and you know, we in the intro to this segment talked about the kind of quiet, hilly country roads. Can you talk about how secure people feel when they ride the back roads in a place like Ozaukee County versus, I mean, I know many of our listeners live in much more urban or densely populated areas, and riding in those places is a much different animal, right?
Yeah, that's correct. The roadways out by us, the traffic, though it's a higher speed limit, there's less traffic, so we're able to, you know, use the roadways. We have our favorite routes that we like to take, and with our road clinic, we teach you how to control the traffic if you're going up a hill and there's cars that are coming up behind you.
What are you getting at? How do you as a cyclist control the traffic?
Well, first of all, we're certified in this type of training through LCI as well as Cycling Savvy, and basically you ride right down the middle of the road as you're going up a hill. You put your hand back behind your hip, and your body language is telling that car, do not even try to pass me right now. And then when you come up to the crest, if it is clear, you can wave them, push over to the side, wave them on. Otherwise, if you see a car coming, you keep your hand down. In fact, you pump your elbow and make sure that they stay back. And a lot of cars are really appreciative of that. Otherwise, they try to squeak around you if you hug the curve to the right, and that's really, really dangerous for you as a bicyclist to get pushed off, as well as them trying to go around.
And that was always a bad habit for me, riding a lot. I just wanted to get out of the way of cars. And again, I rode for many, many years, and I've had this training recently. They basically say, no, you need to get out and be visible and essentially have some control over the behavior of drivers. It's a little unnerving at first, but once you build that confidence, you find that the drivers are actually appreciative. Oh, you didn't put me in a dangerous situation. Mm-hmm. So we can mutually share the road, and again, share the road within the laws and within good practices of riding.
There are some things like going up a hill and keeping traffic back that all cyclists face. Are there some specific challenges that women face as they get into the sport? Safety, I'm thinking of, you know, it's a different thing to be out riding alone as a woman.
That's a really good point. Again, Ozaukee County is pretty safe county. There's enough traffic on the roads. If you do have a flat or something and you don't know how to change it, that somebody could come along and assist you. And there's a lot of other bicyclists also that are out there that can help you. But again, that's something that you can go to your local bike shop and they'll teach you some of those skills so that you feel safer out there.
And that's one of the things we teach in our road clinics, not only, you know, the traffic safety, the handling skills, but also changing a flat tire, especially among the women's group, getting that rear tire off And we make them do it so they have that experience. And that'll actually make them feel safe, because that's the most vulnerable point that you would have is a flat tire in the side of the road. If you can get yourself going, that'll help you tremendously in terms of safety and confidence.
So before we wrap up, we mentioned that you don't run races. I mean, Brian, your experience was in racing before, but for women who get into this and they want to take it beyond recreation and into the competitive arena, what do you recommend? Who do you send them to?
Oh, there's a number of different clubs throughout the state that we could recommend. Again, we don't do any racing, but we can get you up to a point. I think, Mitch, you can even have a little testimony on that.
Yes. I don't race.
No, you don't.
I might have a woman in my life who does, though.
Yes, he does. So, and I took her out on the country roads and got her up to a certain speed. And then when she decided that there was a particular sport, which was track racing, we turned her over to that. And she went every other week at the track and then with me until she was, and now she does track racing. And we're very proud of her.
So am I.
Yes.
Well, thank you very much, both of you, for doing what you do and also for telling us about it here on Lake Effect. And I am assuming people can go to your website and find out the events that you've got going on.
Yes, they're listed on WisconsinWomenCycling.com.
Cindy Pettit is founder of Wisconsin Women Cycling, and Brian Pettit is an instructor and coach for the organization. Thank you both so much.
Thank you.
My pleasure. Thank you.
For people who would rather take a walk through the area rather than a ride, we're going to talk next to the director of the Mequon Nature Preserve. That's when Lake Effect On-Site returns in a moment on 89.7 WUWM.
This is an encore presentation of our Lake Effect On-Site show in Cedarburg.
Lake Effect continues on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. We are recording in front of a studio audience at the Cedarburg Cultural Center. I'm Mitch Tyke.
And I'm Bonnie North. And a quick hand for our house band tonight. We'll hear more from them in a bit, but right now, we might think of places like where we are right now as being defined by urban sprawl, but there's still a lot of open space to be found here in Ozaukee County, whether it's a strawberry farm or a nature preserve. And our next guest knows a thing or two about that latter thing.
Kristen Geese has done some amazing things with the more than 400 acres that comprise the Mequon Nature Preserve. It is a place where people reconnect with nature, or in the case of some school children, connect with nature in the first place. It is held up as a shining example of habitat restoration in the midst of a metropolitan area. Kristen Geese, welcome to Lake Effect.
Thank you so much for having me.
So what are the pressures on land here that something like the Mequon Nature Preserve is so important?
Well, that's starting off with a very important, challenging question. You know, I think it's critical. I think right now with the climate in the political scene, the climate literally, the state of the environment across the world, it's crucial. It's critical. We need to protect land. And at the end of the day, if we don't have an environment, we have nothing else. So it kind of starts with that. The philanthropic pendulum is so low on it, too. So it's really critical to understand that land preservation is necessary. So,
well, so for people who may have only connected with the Mequon Nature Preserve by driving past it on 76th Street, or I guess it's Wauwatosa Avenue at that
point.
At
about 60 miles an hour, correct.
Yeah, exactly. What is contained in those 400-plus acres, and how has it gotten here?
Oh, right. I think my favorite, and you can't see when you're up in this live audience, but I usually say, how many people have been to the Nature Preserve? Raise your hand. I think I can see. Yeah, about like 2, 4, maybe a little more. Just kidding.
So 18. Yeah,
exactly. Was that 18? Oh, I'm doing pretty good out here then. A lot of people drive past. So 444 acres is what we're comprised of today. And it's gorgeous. It's, dare I say, biosphere. It's this incredible epicenter where habitat is being actively restored. So you might walk through and see some farm fields, which today are not all planted. Thank you, Mother Nature, for throwing us a curveball. But the farm fields, some are still in existence. We can't do it all at once. Some are restored beautiful mesic wetland systems. Some are newly planted prairies. Some acres are mature hardwood forests, some that's never been tilled. It's just this beautiful composition, patchwork quilt, if you will, of ecosystems. And it's amazing to watch the species return. You know that, what was the movie, If You Build It, They Will Come? Gosh, that's factual, actually, in science. So.
Real-life Field of Dreams.
Oh, it is. Yeah.
Now, all of those different kinds of habitats, were they in this area to begin with before humans were here?
Right. Well, you know, that is a challenge, to really dissect what we've done. Our fingerprint is deeper than we realize. So if you were to ask a botanist, right? They would tell you they've got about 250 years to restore it back to a mesic forest. So we would have been a wet forest around here, really wet because of the lake composition. The rivers were much, much wider than they are today, so mesic forest. However, you ask a soil scientist, and they'll tell you got over 1,000 years to repair the damages done. So yeah, mesic forest is a really quick universal name of what this region would have been.
How did you decide what ought to be represented within that 440 acres?
A whole lot of scientists hanging out. So we definitely, I wish I could tell you that I get to magic wand it or something. But no, we have a lot of group of scientists that study that land. They've done the soil sciences. They've done those botanical composition. They've looked back into record keeping. And then we had the beauty of one of our remnant forests really was never tilled. And we had records of data that date back into the 1800s of what was there. So we kind of set ourselves up with success of building a team of people who really understood it.
What do you see as the mission of the Nature Preserve?
Oh, man. We don't have enough time. It's okay. The mission is to restore the land to a beautiful composition for these species. It's critical species. There's so many of them today. I could talk for hours, right? You've got the monarch butterfly. Please help the monarch. It's necessary. If we pull that out of the food web, what's going to happen, right? Or the honeybee. I have so many people thought, like, oh, yeah, a land without honey, what would we do? No. It's not a land without honey. It's a land without, what are you going to eat? You know? So I think we want to be a place in which species are heard. We want to be the voices for the trees. We want to be the voices for the plants. And then in doing that, we want to teach the children to not leave that deep of a fingerprint that maybe we already had done, right? Teach them how to live with the land, side by side with agricultural practices. Don't hear me wrong. We have Fondi Food Center on our land. We love farming, but it can be blended beautifully with restoration. So
how do you get people excited about nature when nature is something, say, like a prairie, which at first glance to humans doesn't look terribly interesting?
Right. That's a really good question. So I think for the children, it's really, really easy. Children are so beautifully, they're a sponge, right? So you take them out there, and to be honest, my favorite way of doing it is to ask, and it's a challenge, for them to be totally silent. And what do you hear? You know, then maybe draw. Like, what do you see? What can you draw for me? And get to understand the various, you know, different connections between those animals and insects and plants and how they're working together. So some of the excitement has to be experiential. We do that with events as well. We engage with a variety of audiences from different clubs. Every week we've got something going on. The field trips are kind of critical, and we encourage parents to join us. I mean, they're free. We're 100% free, so just show up. What's wrong with free? You know.
What is a day in the life of the executive director of the Mequon Nature Preserve? Besides appearing on a radio show.
Yeah, this is the highlight. I would say it's a lot of conversations. You know, my job is really to communicate and be that voice, to be the backbone for my staff, my beautiful staff that I couldn't do anything without. They work so hard every day to communicate to the public, to the children, of the importance of the work we're doing. And I'm going to say I'm one giant support system. And then I hope to be in the community more and engage with especially our city government often to keep moving the mission forward.
How do you get funding?
I gravel every day. That's actually 99% of my job. For all of you wonderful people in the audience, thank you kindly. No, donation. We are 100%, no tax dollars come to us. It is grants and foundations and individual donors. Several who are here, thank you kindly for your donation.
When you get out there, when you actually have a chance to go out there, what are some of the things you look for and alternately are surprised by?
I have a moment from actually not that long ago. So I am a botanist by trade, a birder wannabe. Okay, I don't know. Don't ask me many birds. I don't know them. And I got to take a gentleman out, actually a board member who was just terming off, and we went hiking, and we went into one of our forests. I love the forest. I feel like I know. I've been there for 12 years, so I feel like I know a lot of this by like the back of my hand. But all of a sudden, I saw these larger birds in a tree and kind of acting. I have to imitate it because it kind of was like drunk. I'm sorry. It's on the radio, you can't really see that. But
they had stopped at the strawberry wine place.
Yes, they did. Yeah. They had awesome wine, but. So they kind of just acted ridiculous. I'm like, what's going on? And we had to stare at it for a while. Well, here was fledglings of owlets learning how to fly. You don't see that. It was great horned owl fledglings. It was breathtaking. I'm forever a birder now. I'm going to figure every bird out. So,
and I love birds of prey, too, particularly. And owls are wonderful.
Owls. And we had our first sandhill crane nesting and baby on the land. So not only are these species returning, they're returning in great numbers, and they're not leaving. They are choosing it as their home. So it's a critical piece of land. It's the division of two watersheds. It's a giant sponge. It filters an enormous amount of water and keeps it out of the deep tunnel system, you know, downstream, and cleans drinking water. I mean, it's such a critical piece of land. So please come out.
talk about the educational components.
Yeah.
What is it that you're able to do that connects kids with the land? I mean, what are the programs?
You know, there are so many nature centers that do such amazing work in education. There's 118, I think was the last survey, in Wisconsin. 118 nature centers. So I think what makes us slightly different is we're free. So there is no financial burden to get a field trip out. And if we predominantly serve 70% of the children we serve are Milwaukee. We serve about 11,000 students in a year. So it's free. We pay for their buses. So we excite them by getting them outside and getting their hands dirty, by planting the trees, by, you know, taking their dip nets and collecting the critters and water sampling. So hands-on learning is what we're doing.
And it is remarkable because the nature preserve is really just a hop, skip, and a jump from where Milwaukee becomes Ozaukee County.
Yeah, across the street. I look across the street at Milwaukee. So, it's pretty cool.
Kristen Geese, thank you so much.
Thank you so much.
Thank you so much for coming on Lake Effect. I'm amazed that it has taken us this long to get you on
Mitch,
to the show.
Mitch, I miss you. It's been it's decades.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Kristen Geese is Executive Director of the Mequon Nature Preserve.
We'll take one more break, and then we're going to formally welcome the band that's been with us all night. Chicken Wire Empire is next on Lake Effect Onsite from 89.7 WUWM.
This is an encore presentation of our Lake Effect Onsite show in Cedarburg.
More of Lake Effect Onsite now, live from the Cedarburg Cultural Center in front of this wonderful studio audience. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Tyke. Gosh, I think we are standing room only here. We have been fortunate to be joined on stage all evening by the members of the band Chicken Wire Empire, which hails from this part of the world. Gentlemen, thank you so much for being here. For folks listening in on the radio who don't see you, why don't we have you each introduce yourself and tell us what instruments you're playing, if you would be so kind.
I'm John Pike. I play the banjo.
I'm Ernest Bruce Abartus IV, and I'm playing the fiddle.
I'm Greg Brundage, and I play the guitar.
I'm Ron Ogburn, and this is the mandolin.
Also Ron Ogburn, this is the upright mandolin. You didn't want to say those last names, I know it, right? I'm also Jordan Kroger, I play the upright bass. Thank you, guys.
Give us a sense for how the five of you came together and turned into the band that you did.
Well, we actually all went to church together. We all come from very different backgrounds, some of us overlapping in different musical genres. All of us listen to NPR religiously.
So we have the church.
We have that common ground.
We like to think of it
not
as
only
the
are
church
we
of public radio.
We're donors as well.
Yeah.
So I encourage all of you, tune into the pledge drive. We all came together basically for the love of music and an age-old tradition of playing music for fun. And that blossomed into a extremely lucrative musical career of playing bluegrass music.
Yeah. Well, we have a note here that says, Bonnie asks questions about newgrass versus traditional bluegrass. And the reason I had that note in there is because you are playing sort of a form of newgrass. And for people who don't know how bluegrass moved from what we think of as like Earl Scruggs and the Flat and Scruggs stuff to kind of what you're doing now, you know, what was the change? How did that evolution happen?
Well, I'm so happy you brought that up. It was just the natural progression that was laid out in the blueprints of bluegrass music. It was itself a very progressive musical style, all the way back to the folk tunes of Europe and even African influence with the banjo. It's such an eclectic genre that the only place for it to move was forward and really test the boundaries of acoustic instruments and stringed instruments.
Yeah, I tend to think of it as more chromatic. You know, there's just all of this wonderful melody, but harmony and really interesting textures, musical textures that are happening.
You're creating a rhythm on a bunch of acoustic instruments. So you're trying to create a pulse like a drum kit would without actually having any drums, minus the banjo.
Right. Which is a percussive instrument, yes.
No, I meant the banjo because it's a drum with a stick through it, not minus the banjo. You guys didn't catch that?
Is that the reason John's at the end of the stage there? Are you just going to knock him off?
Right.
Yeah.
I want to ask you a really superficial question at one level, but I think it's one that maybe there are people in the audience that are wondering about and would be interested in the answers. So Bonnie and I are sitting here. We're talking into these pretty standard stage microphones. They're Sennheiser somethings. They're wireless microphones. For people who can't see on the radio, the microphones that you are singing into are a fair sight different, and they really look like a throwback to the old days. Tell us about what you're singing and playing into.
You know, they may appear to be very expensive vintage microphones, and that's what they are. No, actually, they are a new company, a newer company out of Portland, Oregon, called Ear Trumpet Labs, that really caters to exactly what we're doing, live performance in an old-timey style.
There is something of a communal feel to the way you do it. You've got three microphones and five musicians, and you're all kind of gathered around as though, you know, you've just kind of pulled us all in.
That's do a little dance.
Little choreography. And it also helps us connect on stage when we can really just not only play the part, but move and really physically try to project our sound and singing into these microphones.
Do you use those when you're recording your albums too? Or is it just a stage thing?
We have various different setups because, as you know, sometimes a bluegrass crowd with a little mix of alcohol can get a little chatty. So, you know, sometimes we plug in and we do a bigger rock show with lights, but this is where the music originates from, and we like the intimate style of this performance.
One of the things I love about it is that everybody leans in for their solo and then steps back and lets somebody else. It's a very wonderful musical sharing.
It is. Sometimes it doesn't work out so well. We have accidents on stage. Instruments have been broken and
oh dear.
People have been elbowed.
Do you ever wear helmets on stage?
Shoulder pads.
Only when we first started, but
okay.
Not anymore.
You do have this recent album out, and I guess give us a sense for what the feel was when you were actually all together putting it together.
Oh, well, a lot of it was old stuff that we wanted to arrange for the new sound. Some of it came to fruition in the studio. Verses weren't written. We just kind of were leaning on a little bit of the magic of the moment in the studio. So we all individually write, but as a group, we arrange the music together. And sometimes a song can turn out completely different from where it started, and sometimes the original songwriter has a clear vision of what's happening. So we tried to mix in a little spontaneity with a lot of planning and charting and
So what is it about this style of music that grabbed all of you? You could be playing
it's
anything.
It's the best.
It's the best? No qualitative
judgment.
The
easiest
here.
Way to get rich, right, yeah,
exactly.
is bluegrass music.
That is not true, but I mean...
Jazz is the easiest way to get rich.
The money's in fiddle and banjo-based music.
Yeah. No, you know what? I do want to say, I'm from Cedarburg, and Ryan's from Grafton, and we started playing... So it was interesting to hear all this, because I grew up on Washington Avenue out here. So this whole conversation to me was incredibly interesting to listen to, and we appreciate being here. But our first shows were right next door, on that side, at the bar right next door, and we used to play down here. So, you know, Ryan introduced me to bluegrass. And
truly, it's about carrying the least amount of gear to a gig as possible. As you can see, we don't have drums or amps. It's just, it all fits in the backseat.
Well, except for the double bass there. Yeah,
he rides on the roof. I didn't luck out, I'll tell you that.
Yeah.
Have you played Strawberry Festival?
Oh, we have. We've also had our share of strawberry wine. Not tonight.
But it's coming. Yeah. Yes. Well, we want to thank you gentlemen for being our house band tonight. Ladies and gentlemen, Chicken Wire Empire, thank you so much for being here.
They are Jordan Kroger on bass, Ryan Ogburn mandolin, John Pike on banjo.
Ernest Brucebardus IV is the fiddler, and Greg Brundage is on guitar. Thank you so much for joining us tonight, lending your bluegrass melodies to our entire program. And so what are you going to take us out with?
We're going to leave you with a song. This one's for you, Mitch.
Don't wanna be treated this way.
So, Chicken Wire Empire. Yep. All right, so before I bid Lake Effect and Milwaukee farewell, yeah, I know. I'm crying already, what can I say? I wanted to interrupt the flow of this show and maybe bring it to a screeching halt for just a moment. When I came to Lake Effect, it wasn't even Lake Effect. It was called At 10. And I was tasked to help it evolve. It was a while ago. I think our first guest was a Neanderthal. So it evolved within a few months to start at 9 o'clock, so we couldn't call it At 10 anymore. And Lake Effect, a name that had popped into my head when my wife and I were moving here from Arizona, was born. That was back in 2006, before just about any of us had Facebook and before Twitter and Instagram existed, and there was exactly zero fanfare. I think 25 or 30 people turned out in Flagstaff to wish us goodbye, and no one here noticed that we arrived. So when I look around here tonight in Cedarburg, I am not so much stunned into silence because dead air is bad, but I am just really, really humbled. So thank you so much for coming tonight. In the 13 plus years I spent at Lake Effect, I did somewhere in the neighborhood of 9,000 interviews. And honestly, if I'm speaking truthfully here, until about interview 8,360, that was you, Daniel Golden, I never really thought this was a marketable skill. You know, you ask someone to come in, you spend some time thinking about what you'd like to know, you write a few questions out, you ask those questions and hope they are not the dumbest things this person has ever been asked. And I guess they weren't, because people keep coming in for interviews, and they're coming in for interviews even after I leave, because I hope if there was one ethos I was able to imprint on this show, to mix a very public radio sounding metaphor, it is that everyone who sits down in our studio or on a stage with us or wherever we talk to them, they're doing us the most remarkable favor in exposing us just a little bit to their life. So the least that we can do is be ready when they get here and treat them with the dignity and the respect and the understanding that we'd expect if the tables were turned. You know, that and frankly, if you are interviewing an author, read the dang book. Anyway, it is not an easy time to leave Milwaukee. This is the place where my kids have been growing up and thriving, where many of my wife's dearest friends are, and where the city is on the verge of great, great things, from the DNC next year to the Brewers whenever they decide to actually take the next step and get to the World Series. But the place I'm going, North Country Public Radio, is equally special. Look it up, it's at ncpr.org. It is a much more rural part of the country, and it is a place that truly, truly needs and appreciates its public radio station. I've learned this business from some really terrific leaders over the years, and now it is my turn to lead, and so I accept the challenge. But it is going to be pretty damn weird not to be working alongside some of the most dedicated people in the world after tonight. Bonnie and Joy and Audrey and our supporting cast, the thousands of people who are here. Lake Effect is in great hands. There is a lot I really would like to say beyond this, but I will get too emotional, and these speeches can get kind of deadly at that point. So suffice it to say, I will miss you guys. And I'll finish by saying, in these last 13 years, they have been golden years. To everyone I have worked with or who I've interviewed, or most importantly, who has listened, thanks to all of you for letting me be a part of your life. I hope it's made your world a little better.
And now we have to actually wrap up the show for air.
Wait, I have to switch scripts.
Switch scripts. And that wraps up today's edition of Lake Effect Onsite. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Tyke. Special thanks to the Cedarburg Cultural Center for hosting us this evening. Audrey Nowakowski joins us in producing Lake Effect each week, along with Joy Powers, the executive producer of our Lake Effect Onsite series. Jason Reavy is our onsite and studio engineer. Michelle Maternowski over there someplace is our managing editor. Christine Lamatina did yeoman's or yeomanwoman's work in marketing this broadcast.
Yes, big applause for her as well. The show also gets help this summer from Ben Benversi, Zoe Munson, Cassidy Schrader. Zoe and Cassidy are here.
For those of you listening in on the radio, thank you so much for tuning in today. For those of you in this amazing studio audience, thank you for being here. I hope you'll be with us again tomorrow and Sunday afternoon at 3 for Lake Effect Weekend on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR.
It is 11 o'clock, so keep listening. Fresh Air is next.